Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we feature new research on polymyalgia rheumatica, hypercholesterolemia, prostate cancer, and multiple myeloma. We review evidence-based strategies for tobacco cessation and follow a case of a woman with nausea, dizziness, and metabolic acidosis. We discuss recent advances in gene editing for rare metabolic diseases. Perspectives address HIV care, healthcare quality, medical ethics, and finding resilience in the face of serious illness. Phase 3 trial of secukinumab in polymyalgia rheumatica by John Stone from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Polymyalgia rheumatica is a common inflammatory disease characterized by pain and stiffness in the shoulders and hips. Glucocorticoids are the first-line treatment, but relapses and glucocorticoid-related toxic effects are common, which underscores the need for effective alternatives. Secukinumab is a fully human monoclonal antibody that selectively inhibits interleukin-17A. In this study, 381 patients with recently relapsed polymyalgia rheumatica were randomly assigned to receive secukinumab at a dose of 300 milligrams or 150 milligrams or placebo for 52 weeks. Patients in all the groups also received prednisone on a tapering schedule for 24 weeks. Treatment with secukinumab plus a 24-week glucocorticoid taper resulted in a higher percentage of patients with remission and with lower cumulative glucocorticoid doses than with placebo and a glucocorticoid taper. Infections and hypersensitivity reactions were more common in the secukinumab groups than in the placebo group, but the incidence of serious infections was similar in both secukinumab groups and the placebo group. No serious hypersensitivity reactions were reported. Yoshiya Tanaka from the University of Occupational and Environmental Health, Kitakyushu, Japan, writes in an editorial that the current report and the recent Phase 3 GC Captain trial, which assessed secukinumab treatment in patients with new-onset or recurrent giant cell arteritis, both from Stone and co-authors, raise hopes for a major therapeutic shift that minimizes the toxic effects of glucocorticoids, especially in older patients who constitute the majority of patients with polymyalgia rheumatica and giant cell arteritis. However, given the relatively modest effect of secukinumab in polymyalgia rheumatica and its lack of efficacy in giant cell arteritis, further research on targeting other or multiple cytokines in the inflammatory network involved in the pathogenesis of these diseases is sorely needed. In vivo base editing of PCSK9 with VERV-102 for hypercholesterolemia by Scott Vafai from Verve Therapeutics, Boston, and co-authors. Persons carrying loss-of-function variants in the gene PCSK9 have reduced levels of low-density lipoprotein, LDL cholesterol, and fewer atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease events than persons without such variants. VERV-102 is an investigational base editing therapy designed to durably inactivate PCSK9 in the liver. The therapy is delivered through a single intravenous infusion. In this Phase 1 study, one intravenous infusion of VERV-102 was administered at one of six doses to 35 adults with heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia or premature coronary artery disease. One dose of this base editing therapy led to dose-dependent, substantial, and sustained reductions in blood PCSK9 protein and LDL cholesterol levels. In an editorial, Børre Nordesgaard from the Copenhagen University Hospital, Herlev and Gentofte, Herlev, Denmark, writes that the pioneering work of Vafai and co-authors should pave the way for a new type of LDL cholesterol-lowering therapy with VERVE 102, which appears to lower LDL cholesterol levels enough to reduce the risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease among persons at high risk. The results provide confidence that VERVE 102 will work. That is, will suppress LDL cholesterol levels for at least 1 year. However, data from more patients are needed to evaluate long-term efficacy and safety. In the future, in vivo DNA base editing to achieve PCSK9 inhibition and sustained lower levels of LDL cholesterol might offer a means of preventing atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease in patients at the very highest risk for the disease. For example, in those with familial hypercholesterolemia, who have very high levels of LDL cholesterol, and in those with elevated levels of remnant cholesterol and lipoprotein A, in addition to LDL cholesterol. Selpercatinib in early-stage RET fusion-positive non-small cell lung cancer by Yilong Wu from the Guangdong Provincial People's Hospital, Guangzhou, China, and co-authors. Selpercatinib, a highly selective, potent, and central nervous system penetrant inhibitor of RET, rearranged during transfection, is approved for RET fusion-positive advanced or metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. This Phase 3 study evaluated the efficacy and safety of selpercatinib in 151 patients with stage 2 or 3A RET fusion-positive non-small cell lung cancer who had received definitive therapy with curative intent, surgery or radiotherapy with adjuvant systemic anticancer therapy, if applicable. Patients were randomly assigned to receive selpercatinib or placebo for up to 3 years. Event-free survival was significantly longer with adjuvant selpercatinib than with placebo. The most common adverse events during the treatment period were increased levels of alanine aminotransferase and aspartate aminotransferase in the selpercatinib group. Talquetamab daratumumab in relapsed or refractory myeloma by Roberto Mina from the University of Turin, Italy, and co-authors. In early phase 1-2 trials, talquetamab, a bispecific antibody targeting GPRC5D and CD3, has led to durable responses in patients with heavily pretreated, relapsed, or refractory multiple myeloma, with a limited effect on normal B cells. In this Phase 3 trial, patients with relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma who had previously received at least one line of therapy were randomly assigned to receive talquetamab plus daratumumab with or without pomalidomide, or daratumumab plus pomalidomide and dexamethasone. Treatment with talquetamab daratumumab with or without pomalidomide led to significantly longer progression-free survival than daratumumab plus pomalidomide and dexamethasone. GPRC5D-related adverse events were common, but infrequently led to treatment discontinuation. Evidence-based tobacco cessation strategies for low- and middle-income countries. A review article by Donna Shelley from New York University, New York. Globally, tobacco use is the leading cause of preventable death, claiming more than 7 million lives each year. The burden of disease is highest in low- and middle-income countries, where more than 80% of the world's 1.3 billion tobacco users reside. The World Health Organization defines 6 proven strategies to reduce tobacco use, referred to by the acronym EMPOWER, with one of the strategies being to offer tobacco users help with quitting. Many low- and middle-income countries provide tobacco cessation services. However, only 31 meet the WHO best practice definition. That is, those providing both cost-covered behavioral interventions and pharmacotherapy. In this article, case studies from India and Vietnam illustrate how cross-country differences in tobacco-related sociocultural norms, tobacco use patterns such as smokeless tobacco or water pipes, the tobacco control regulatory environment, industry influence, and healthcare system financing shape treatment access and uptake. These cases further show that cost-effective population-level strategies, including quit lines, digital interventions, and system-wide screening for tobacco use paired with clinician advice to quit, are essential for expanding treatment reach. Combining these interventions with pharmacotherapy products that are included on the WHO model list of essential medicines, that is, cytisine and nicotine replacement therapy, further improves cessation outcomes. System-level models, such as the Ask, Advise, Connect model, Ask About Tobacco Use, Advise to Quit, Connect to Cessation Help, offer a feasible, low-burden pathway for integrating cessation care into routine practice. A 28-year-old woman with nausea, dizziness, and metabolic acidosis. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Hilary Cranmer and colleagues. A 28-year-old woman had a sudden onset of abdominal pain, dizziness, nausea, and vomiting after the consumption of spicy food. Her partner had consumed the same food but did not have similar symptoms. The patient had persistent vomiting and lightheadedness and was unable to maintain adequate hydration. Subsequently, she presented to the emergency department the following day. Her partner reported that the patient had presented to the emergency department with similar symptoms 2 months earlier. While in the emergency room during the current visit, the patient became increasingly anxious and agitated. Laboratory studies revealed severe, high anion gap metabolic acidosis with a markedly elevated osmolar gap despite normal glucose, kidney function, and lactate levels. CT imaging showed no abdominal abnormality, and the cause of her illness remained unclear. The metabolic findings raised concern for toxic alcohol poisoning, and she was treated immediately with fomepizole, sodium bicarbonate, and emergency hemodialysis before confirmatory results were available. Blood testing later confirmed severe methanol toxicity. Her acid-base abnormalities rapidly resolved with treatment, and methanol levels became undetectable after dialysis. Despite extensive evaluation, the source of the methanol exposure was never identified, and she was discharged after recovering clinically. Gene editing, peroxisomal disorders, and treatments for rare disease. A Clinical Implications of Basic Research by Rebecca Ahrens-Nicholas from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Individual inborn errors of metabolism are rare, yet are quite common collectively, occurring in approximately 1 in 2,000 births. Each disorder arises from disease-causing genetic variants that disrupt biochemical pathways in cells. Because the liver is a metabolic hub, many inborn errors of metabolism cause liver dysfunction, cirrhosis, or frank liver failure. These disorders are often associated with high morbidity and early death, and most lack approved disease-modifying therapies. Over the last decade, targeted genetic therapies have emerged as potential solutions for certain rare genetic disorders, including hepatic inborn errors of metabolism. Because most patients present in infancy or childhood, early treatment is essential to maximize benefit. One major challenge is that adeno-associated viral vectors, a commonly used delivery tool, typically do not integrate into a person's genome, and if a person receives the treatment during infancy, the efficacy may wane. Therapeutic gene editing with CRISPR-based tools may provide a more durable approach to restoring target gene expression. A recent study by Gao et al. Highlights the potential of this emerging class of therapies to treat Zellweger spectrum disorders, which are severe inborn errors of peroxisomal metabolism. The study highlights the potential of liver-directed base editing therapies to address the root cause of inherited metabolic disorders. Rethinking the role of pay-for-performance in federal healthcare quality programs. A perspective by Michael Chernu from Harvard Medical School and Eric Schneider from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston. For more than two decades, policymakers, industry stakeholders, and patient advocates have endeavored to improve the quality of healthcare. These efforts have often relied on a pay-for-performance, P4P, paradigm that involves establishing performance measures, assigning performance scores to health plans, delivery organizations, and practitioners, and attaching financial rewards or penalties to measured performance. This measure-score-pay approach is grounded in a belief that even relatively small financial incentives can shift behavior when implemented on a broad scale. It underpins several large Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, programs. P4P was an important step that focused attention on gaps in quality in U.S. healthcare, inspired interventions to address them, and promoted investments in quality-focused personnel and infrastructure. Yet returns have been disappointing. These authors believe the healthcare system's continued over-reliance on P4P to drive quality improvement is problematic. The costs and limitations of the measure-score-pay paradigm are becoming increasingly apparent. A more effective approach would be to be realistic about what national policy can achieve. CMS could move beyond the current paradigm by using a narrow set of high-impact measures to target improvement of low-performing but essential plans or organizations. Without such changes, the promise of value-based care is unlikely to be realized. Long-acting treatment and advanced HIV disease, addressing a public health priority. A perspective by Jonathan Falconer from Médecins Sans Frontières, Cape Town, South Africa, and co-authors. Long-acting injectable antiretroviral therapy, ART, represents one of the most important advances in HIV treatment and prevention of the past decade. The Phase 3 PURPOSE trials revealed that lenacapavir, a first-in-class capsid inhibitor, offers near-complete protection when administered twice yearly as pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP. But the public health value of adopting long-acting injectable ART as treatment will depend on its effectiveness in the population that has the most to gain. People living with HIV who have unsuppressed viral loads and advanced disease. These authors believe that there is now an urgent need to conduct pragmatic, randomized trials of long-acting injectable ART in populations with or at high risk for advanced HIV disease. Long-acting injectable ART has been framed largely as a convenience-driven innovation. For people with advanced HIV disease, it may represent something more fundamental, a method capable of overcoming the structural limitations of current care models, which continue to drive preventable deaths and HIV transmission. Resistance, strategic compromise, or complicity. Physicians' choices under ethical pressure. A perspective by Matthew Winia from the University of Colorado Center for Bioethics and Humanities, Aurora. Faced with pressure to violate professional ethics, How can physicians tell the difference between a strategic compromise and complicity in hurting patients, undermining science, or damaging other core professional values? In the past year, multiple physicians employed by U.S. federal agencies have quit their jobs, refusing to be complicit in leaders' actions that they believe are harmful to science and public health. Yet others, presumably including some with similar concerns, have chosen to stay. When is staying in a job that demands a sacrifice of professional values complicity? And when is it a legitimate, perhaps even heroic, attempt at damage control? These complex questions often lack single right answers. Physicians who are pressed to act unethically can consider three questions to help them decide whether a proposed response constitutes unethical complicity or is a reasonable strategic compromise. Whose interests are served? What benefits or risks are at stake? And third, should an act of resistance be private or public? Last Man Running, a perspective by James Rosenbaum from the Legacy Devers Eye Institute, Portland, Oregon. Dr. Rosenbaum's older brother, Rick, has ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Rick is enduring an inexorable decline. The cruel irony is that Rick is a neurologist and knows all too well the course of this disease. Another cruel irony, but also blessing, is that his cognitive function is totally intact. But while his recall ability is unimpaired, he lacks the motor function to speak or to care for himself. For 35 years, Dr. Rosenbaum went running every week with his brother Rick and also Ed, a neurosurgeon and their dear friend. They were like the Three Musketeers, roving the westernmost hills of Portland, Oregon. Dr. Rosenbaum hated jogging. He found it painful. Yet he recalled the observation of an existentialist philosopher that the beauty of pain lies in the knowledge that you need to be alive to perceive it. Running reminds him that he is alive. But to his own surprise, Dr. Rosenbaum nearly died recently. For about 3 years, maybe 6 or 8 times per year, Dr. Rosenbaum has had episodes of lightheadedness, and he had had a minor surgical procedure to insert a loop recorder to document his heart rhythm and transmit the results to his cardiologist. Then one night recently, he awoke at 4:30 a.m. with a bit of nausea. He headed to the bathroom for a sip of water, and the next thing he knew, he was lying on the bathroom floor. He managed to crawl back into bed, sweating and nauseated. The classic manifestations of vasovagal syncope. 28 hours or so after that event, Dr. Rosenbaum's cardiologist called to report that Dr. Rosenbaum's heart had stopped for roughly 40 seconds, with the exception of one beat that snuck in during the pause, accounting for the loss of consciousness. The next day, Dr. Rosenbaum had a cardiac pacemaker inserted. Thousands of people faint every day. When they choose to go to the emergency department, almost always no cause is found. What Dr. Rosenbaum learned from his own experience is that he is grateful to be alive. And he is both less and more afraid of dying. Life is precious and precarious. Now, he is the last musketeer slogging through the Portland hills. His brother, the neurologist, needs a Hoyer lift to get into bed. And their friend, the neurosurgeon, can't ambulate without assistance because of Parkinson's disease. So Dr. Rosenbaum chooses to keep running. He clings to the fantasy that the ability to run 3 or more miles per day means he is invincible. Or if not invincible, at least in motion. In our images in clinical medicine, a 55-year-old man with a 10-pack-year smoking history presented with 2 years of an enlarging painless lump below his right ear. A previously unnoticed smaller mass in the left parotid gland was seen on examination, a diagnosis of Worthen tumors, benign, slow-growing salivary gland tumors that are strongly associated with smoking and that often occur on both sides was made. In another image, a 61-year-old man with prolonged neutropenia as a result of salvage chemotherapy for acute myeloid leukemia was evaluated for persistent fever despite treatment with broad-spectrum antimicrobial agents. Physical examination was notable for a macule with central necrosis on the chest, as well as a nodule on the left palm. Imaging showed multiple pulmonary nodules and hypoattenuating lesions in the liver, spleen, and kidneys. Disseminated fusariosis was diagnosed. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.